everybody. Welcome back to the Biographics Podcast. I'm Simon, and this episode today originally aired on our YouTube channel. If you like it, please do consider heading over to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving us a rating and or a review. 5 stars or whatever is always preferred, but do be honest. Let us know how we're doing. Really do appreciate it. And let's get into today's episode.
He was the undisputed king of rock and roll. In the mid-1950s, 20-year-old Elvis Presley exploded onto the airwaves. With a rockabilly blend of country music and blues, his curled lip and trademark wiggling hips, the Southern boy caused a sensation. Coming just as youth culture was taking off, Elvis was everything these new teenagers wanted. He was dangerous, rebellious, and anathema to their parents. Across the nation, preachers denounced him from their pulpits. Judges issued writs against him for corrupting morals. The National Guard was even called to one of his concerts. If you were alive in 1956, then you likely thought Elvis was either the sexiest or most dangerous man alive. Yet, who feels that way today? Mention Elvis's name now, and you're most likely to conjure images of a fat, sweaty dude warbling away in Las Vegas, his preposterous white suit still stained with the grease of 10,000 hamburgers. So, how did the king of rock and roll transform into its blubbery punchline? Well, today, Biographics, we're gonna get in our DeLorean and go all the way back to the 1950s to witness the birth of a new generation and the life of that generation's greatest icon. Although he grew up to become the king, there was nothing noble about the story of Elvis's birth. On January 8, 1935, Elvis Aaron Presley was born into a world that was groaning under the weight of the Great Depression. His father, Vernon Presley, was an odd-job man, while his mother, Gladys, was barely scraping by. The two lived in East Tupelo, a small town known back then as one of the roughest places in Mississippi. Although the family did have their own house, a two-room shotgun shack practically small enough to fit inside your average briefcase, it was without electricity, indoor plumbing, or much of anything else. In fact, the Presleys were so poor that they had to rely on welfare to pay the doctor who delivered Elvis, or rather, delivered Elvis and his twin. Yes, twin. Elvis was originally meant to be brother to Jesse Garon Presley, but the younger twin emerged stillborn. And he almost wasn't the only one. The birth nearly killed both Gladys and Elvis, and the two were rushed to hospital. Although both pulled through, the shock of losing Jesse seems to have permanently scarred Gladys. For the rest of her life, she would be ferociously overprotective of Elvis. But that was all for the future. For the first part of his life, baby Elvis experienced nothing but non-stop deprivation. Gladys and Vernon were so poor that they had to rely on their neighbors to buy diapers. Shockingly, this was their financial high point. In 1938, Vernon was jailed for forging a $4 check, and their shack was repossessed. As Gladys moved about staying with friends, 3-year-old Elvis took to sitting out on the front steps, bawling his eyes out for his dad to come home. Yet even after Vernon's early 1939 release for good behavior, things still did not improve for the family. They spent years bouncing between different rental places, moving in and out of public assistance housing. There's a great little legend attached to this. Aged 4, Elvis is supposed to have overheard his parents arguing about money and told them not to worry because one day he was going to buy them a Cadillac. Needless to say, this childish boast would turn out to be more accurate than Vernon or Gladys could have ever predicted. And so life passed. Vernon continued doing odd jobs, and the family continued wallowing in poverty, and Elvis finally started school. But even now, there were signs of the legend that he would become. In 1945, one of Elvis's teachers overheard him singing. She was so impressed by his voice that she took him to the principal, who was so impressed that he insisted that Elvis enter a talent show. That was how, on October the 3rd, 10-year-old Elvis came to stand up at the Mississippi, Alabama Fair and Dairy Show and sing Old Shep. The event was broadcast on WELO Radio, the first time the world, or Mississippi at any rate, heard Elvis Presley's voice. While we'd love to tell you that some stock character in the studio immediately cried, "Gazooks, this kid's got something!" The reality was actually nothing so narratively pleasing. Instead, Elvis placed a paltry 5th in the talent show, and well, that was that. Except, of course, it wasn't. On Elvis's 11th birthday, Gladys took him to buy a present. Elvis was determined to either get a rifle or a bike, but both gifts were so dangerous that just thinking about them gave the overprotective Gladys palpitations. So she convinced her son to make do with a cheaper gift instead, one which would keep him out of trouble. And that's how, in January 1946, Elvis Presley got his first guitar. The next big shift in young Elvis's life came in November 1948. That month, Vernon and Gladys moved all the way north to Memphis, hoping for a fresh start. For their music-loving son, it was like spending your entire life listening to only one tune, only to suddenly discover Spotify exists and, well, dear God, there's music everywhere. Although the family were still in public housing, it was now in a city thrumming with blues, with country, with gospel, with anything that might make you dance. At school, too, the new city meant a new Elvis. Suddenly, the boy was wearing his hair long, well, long for the 50s, and slicked back and pairing it with colorful, stylish outfits. Out went Elvis, the mama's boy and teacher's pet, and in came Elvis, the rock and roll rebel. At least, that was the image. In reality, Elvis pretty much stayed out of trouble, despite what his swagger might have suggested. Okay, so now let's jump forward a few years, past the end of the 40s, past the Korean War, and right on to the summer of 1953, where Elvis had just graduated and got a job driving trucks. At this point, America is on the cusp of becoming what you imagine when you think of 1950s USA. The portable transistor radio was months away from debuting, Little Richard had just signed with Peacock Records, and rock and roll was slowly becoming a bit of a thing. Teens, they were starting to become consumers, leading to the first ripples of youth culture. In short, it was a world transforming, with a new teen-led culture just waiting for its leader. It would find him in Memphis. That summer, 1953, Elvis got a $4 advance from his job and went to the Memphis Recording Service to cut a single. In later years, the King would simply say that he wanted to hear what he sounded like, but since the service was owned by Sun Records' Sam Phillips, it seemed more likely that Elvis wanted to get noticed. Not that that immediately happened. After famously telling the assistant at the service, "I don't sound like nobody," Elvis cut his record and paid his $4, and, well, there was nothing. For a whole year, Elvis waited, driving trucks and hoping for the best. At some point in those 12 months, he must have started to wonder if his music career was ever going to go anywhere. Then, on June the 26th, 1954, he finally got the call. Marion Kiesker at Sun Records wanted to know if he could be at the studio by 3. As Elvis later said, "I was there by the time she hung up the phone." The session Elvis sang in that day wasn't great, but it was good enough for Sam Phillips to call him back on July the 5th. That day, nothing much seemed to be happening in the booth. No magic, no nothing. Bummed out, everyone took a break. And that's when it happened. To unwind, Elvis casually started playing a version of Arthur Crudup's blues song, That's All Right, only with a faster tempo and a laid-back style. As he played, session guitarist Scotty Moore and bassist Bill Black joined in. Suddenly, the song was transformed into something more than blues. It was a whole new sound. The trio cut their single that very same day. None of them could have known it as they left the studio and stepped out into their warm Memphis evening, but they'd just found their golden ticket. When That's All Right hit the airwaves, it was going to transform their lives. When fame came for Elvis, it didn't slowly court him, it grabbed him like some kind of out-of-control fame hawk, dragging him right up into the stratosphere. On July the 8th, local station WHBQ was handed Elvis's record by Sam Phillips and asked to play it. When they did, the switchboard lit up like a Christmas tree. So many people called in that WHBQ played That's All Right again and again and again. By the time the show ended, Elvis's record had been heard all over the state and people were going nuts. From that point on, Elvis's destiny was fixed. He was gonna be the biggest damn star that Memphis had ever seen. The summer was a wild one for the boy and his musicians. From driving trucks, Elvis was suddenly being driven all over Tennessee, all over the Deep South, playing endless gigs. Because they only had that one record, that's all they played. Johnny Cash later recalled seeing Elvis at one gig just sing That's All Right over and over, like a record stuck on repeat. Yet people loved it. Try and imagine for a moment what it must have felt like to be Elvis Presley that summer. How it must have felt driving from town to town, the windows rolled down and a cool breeze blowing through your slicked back hair, knowing that your time had come. It must have been magical, the sort of feeling you can't ever recapture. On October the 16th, Elvis played the Louisiana Hayride radio show, his voice transmitting to 13 states. The response was so good that producers had him sign a year-long contract then and there. It meant enough money for him to quit his day job. But Hayride is important in the Elvis story for another reason. A month after Elvis began his contract, a shady music promoter began working with Hayride, a guy who claimed he was from West Virginia but couldn't quite hide his Dutch accent. Yes, it is time to introduce Colonel Tom Parker. A major impresario in the South, Parker is a guy with a background so strange it's tempting to think that he's just stepped out of a Hollywood noir. He claimed to be American but was really from the Netherlands. His title of colonel was only honorary, and the one time he'd really been in the army, he'd actually deserted. His past was full of weird tales, like running carnival road shows or intentionally eating until he was too fat to fight in World War II. He likely wasn't a naturalized US citizen, and it's even thought today that he might have fled the Netherlands after killing someone. But Parker did have one vital skill. He knew talent when he saw it, and he knew how to make that talent a household name. Elvis finally met Parker on January the 15th, 1955. Immediately, Parker began to muscle into the young man's career, pushing Elvis's other manager out of the picture. At times, this was done via ballsy moves like stumping up $10,000 of his own money to buy Elvis out of his Sun Records contract so that he could move into the bigger label RCA. At others, it was done via almost sociopathic behavior. Within days of James Dean's death in a car wreck that September, Parker was on the phone to Warner Brothers insisting that they just stick Elvis in any unfinished James Dean film. But if Elvis disapproved of these methods, or of the man himself, he didn't show it. On November the 21st, 1955, Elvis signed the RCA contract Parker had negotiated. It netted him $5,000, plus a guarantee that it'd play on television within 60 days. On January the 28th, 1956, Elvis sang for the first time to a national audience on CBS's stage show. At the time, Elvis was a mere 20 years old. By the time he turned 21, he'd be the biggest star on the planet. When Elvis arrived on the national stage, it was amid a whirlwind of controversy. We don't just mean as a white guy playing black music, although that annoyed plenty. We mean something almost more concerning to 1950s prudes. Elvis was sexy. You know those images of Beatlemania with teenage girls screaming their heads off for any Beatle who wasn't Ringo? Well, that was Elvis in 1956. Something about the way he wiggled his hips just seemed to send teenage uteruses wild. And that meant sending the parents of those teenagers into meltdown. At a concert in Jacksonville, Florida, a judge issued a preemptive arrest warrant against Elvis for impairing the morals of minors should he swivel his hips in the state. In his hometown of Tupelo, 100 National Guardsmen surrounded the stage to stop a riot from breaking out. This wasn't music. It was something dangerous, the oral equivalent of James Dean in Rebel Without a Cause. But Elvis had the good luck to ride this cultural wave just as the mainstream caught on. At the beginning of 1956, an outraged Ed Sullivan declared that he'd never have Elvis on his show. By September, Elvis was playing the Ed Sullivan Show before an estimated 60 million people, 80% of the viewing audience. 1956 Elvis may have started out dangerous and sexy, but the mainstream was already embracing him, making him rich, but also leaving him about as edgy as Dennis the Menace. By January 1957, Ed Sullivan was even telling his viewers that Elvis is a decent, fine boy. But the real nail in the rebel coffin arrived in December. That was the month Elvis was drafted. The king may have played the rebel on stage, but when it came down to it, he was a polite southern patriot, and he accepted his commission without complaint. For teens in the grip of Elvis mania, this was the cultural equivalent of Armageddon. Tens of thousands of letters flooded the draft board begging for Elvis to be exempted, but the king wanted to go. On March the 24th, 1958, Elvis reported for duty. His hair and sideburns were shorn off in front of the cameras, and he was packed off for basic training. Before he went, Colonel Parker made the boy record a ton of singles to be slowly released over the next 2 years to stop his star from fading. But while Parker would succeed in keeping Elvis in the public's mind, he wouldn't be able to maintain the sexy aura Elvis had projected just a couple of years before. That was now gone forever. Over in Germany, Elvis began the newest and perhaps ickiest chapter of his life. In September 1959, the 24-year-old star met Priscilla Beaulieu, who you'll know better as the future Priscilla Presley. The problem? In 1959, she was only 14. And so we come to the most difficult part of today's video. It is true that this was a different time. Jerry Lee Lewis, Chuck Berry, Charlie Chaplin, and over the next decade and a half, Jimmy Page, David Bowie, and Iggy Pop would all have similar underage relationships. On the other hand, a man in his 20s having a relationship with a girl of 14 was as immoral then as it is now. And Elvis seemed to know this. Although he and Priscilla did many things together, they always stopped short of sex, presumably so Elvis could avoid a statutory rape charge. The worst of Elvis's behavior is usually attributed to his later life drug addiction, but his seduction of an underage girl suggests that there were problems that stemmed from someplace much darker. The King's stint in the army finally ended on March 2, 1960. That day, he was put on a military transport and flown back to the States. Just weeks later, he cut the Elvis's Back album. After 2 long years in the wilderness, the King had finally returned. The 60s were a weird time to be Elvis. On the one hand, this was the decade when he became so stinking rich that he never had to worry about money again. On the other hand, it was also the decade when things started going, well, a bit weird. Let's tackle the successes first. Between 1960 and 1968, Elvis released some 30 movies, nearly all of them bringing him, the studio, and Colonel Tom Parker a tidy profit. He also kept recording hits, although these were rarely hits in the era-defining way that That's All Right had been. Still, Elvis and his family comfortably entered the 1%, allowing him to finally marry the no-longer-underage Priscilla in Las Vegas in 1967. Less than a year later, their daughter, Lisa Marie Presley, was born. Alright, so that's the highlights. Now let's dig into the less good stuff. Although Elvis was doing well financially, the movies and songs bringing that money in were, well, not so great. Artistically, watching 60s Elvis is like watching Michelangelo follow up the Sistine Chapel by dedicating his life to paintings of dogs playing poker. You could admire the craft, but really? The slump in Elvis's taste can be easily seen in his legendary 1965 meeting with the Beatles. Although he and the Fab Four eventually had a good time jamming together, John Lennon's opening remark to the King was, "Why do you do all these soft-centered ballads for the cinema these days? What happened to good old rock and roll?" It's not the only nail that Lennon hit squarely on the head that day. After their jam session, Lennon told people that Elvis had been stoned the entire time. Although the King's hefty drug use is usually said to have started later, it seems that by the mid-60s, he was already on that slippery slope. It was also during the 1960s that Elvis began to develop his eating disorder. The first references come from the start of the decade, with interviewers remarking how Elvis liked to eat piles of junk food. Before the 60s were out, the King was turning to comfort eating more and more. We've read people say that when he was feeling low, eating was the only thing that could make Elvis feel normal again. Even his new marriage had a dark side. For whatever weird reason, Elvis was obsessed with virginity. Priscilla later told an interviewer that Elvis had mentioned to me before we were married that he had never been able to make love to a woman who had a child. And that hang-up, it remained. After Lisa Marie Presley was born, Elvis never had sex with Priscilla again. Within a few years, the lack of contact would drive Priscilla to have an affair that would end their marriage. Yet despite all of this, the decade ended on something of a high. In early 1968, Tom Parker had cut a deal with NBC to do a bland one-hour special of Elvis singing Christmas songs. When the project got underway, it slipped out of the Colonel's control and instead became a music industry legend. Sick of being a bland mass entertainer, Elvis concocted something that would become known as the 68 Comeback Special. Clad in black leather, his figure once again trim, Elvis strode onto the stage for the last time, exuding cool. In a wide-ranging set, he rocked the classics, did some unplugged acoustic stuff, and engaged in banter with the audience. By the time the curtain went down, over 42% of the nation had tuned in to watch, and the feeling was undeniable. 1956 Elvis, sexy, dangerous Elvis, was back. But it was a fleeting moment, a last gasp of rock and roll from a bygone performer. A few months later, Elvis began his residency at the Las Vegas International Hotel, getting paid $1 million annually to entertain tourists over their lobster dinner. And so, in the big fight in Elvis's head between commercial success and artistic expression, it was commercial success which won. The last 8 years of Elvis's life were like watching a slow-motion clown car crash. Disturbing, but also kind of darkly amusing. By Christmas 1970, Elvis was so rich and so weird that he was able to spend $100,000 on 32 handguns and 10 Mercedes as a present to himself. When Priscilla hit the roof, he stormed out of the house, got on a jet to Washington, and decided that he wanted to meet the president. And that's how Elvis Presley came to be photographed shaking hands with Richard Nixon, who was so grateful that he gave the king a badge from the Federal Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. By now, the once polite Southern boy was so rich he could do whatever he wanted, and he was just surrounded by toadying yes-men and diving deeper into a drug habit. And what he wanted to do next was just keep on digging deeper. In February 1972, Elvis and Priscilla separated, with their divorce coming through a year later. With his wife and child gone, Elvis seems to have lost the last rope tethering him to planet Earth. Oh sure, he still packed out the International in Las Vegas, he still found time to record late hits like Suspicious Minds, but his life was now simply one long-delayed suicide attempt. By 1975, Elvis was living as an almost total recluse in Graceland, only waking up long after the sun had set, like some sort of junk food addicted vampire. Speaking of junk food, what had begun as comfort eating had now become an ugly obsession. Elvis's favorite late-life snack was Fool's Gold Loaf, which involves taking an entire loaf of bread, hollowing it out, and cramming it full of peanut butter, jelly, and half a kilo of bacon before deep-frying the whole thing. The average male consumes around 2,500 calories a day. A single Fool's Gold loaf contains over 8,000. And Elvis never stopped with just a single loaf. In his last few months, Elvis started living with 21-year-old Ginger Alden, who witnessed his behavior degenerate into pure self-destruction. He would do stuff like fire his handguns at the TV. He once put a bullet in the wall next to her head when she tried to make him stop eating yogurt. Remember earlier when we asked you to try and imagine what it would have been like to be Elvis in the summer of 1954? Well, let's try again now. Try to imagine what it must have felt like to be trapped in this sagging body, locked away in Graceland, never seeing daylight, your soul nothing but an empty void you keep trying to fill with food and pills. Now compare those two mental images and ask yourself, what the hell happened? Finally, all the abuse, it got too much for Elvis's body. On August the 16th, 1977, the king died in the bathroom of his Graceland mansion, allegedly while sat on his throne. He was only 42 years old. When the news broke that the king was gone, mourners gathered in vast crowds at Graceland. Although the man who died had been a bloated, drug-addicted mess, that wasn't the man they were there to remember. They were there to remember the boy who, in a few short years in the 1950s, had changed their lives, opens them up to a new and dangerous thing called rock and roll. As Bruce Springsteen later said of Elvis's early years, it was like he whispered his dream in all our ears, and then we dreamed it. Today, the jury is still out on Elvis Presley. For every person whose teenage years were lit up by his voice, there is someone else who only ever saw him as the sweaty fat guy in Vegas, the bygone buffoon who died while taking a crap. Yet there's no doubt that Elvis was an important figure. Here was a man who almost single-handedly forged an entire era in pop culture. Take away Elvis, and you have no Beatles, no Rolling Stones, no foundation for modern music. He may have done some dubious things, he may have ended his life as a parody of his former self, but there's no doubt that Elvis deserves to be remembered not as a joke, but as a young man in the summer of 1954, the window rolled down as he drives to his next gig, ready to change the world.
So I really hope you enjoyed that episode of the Biographics Podcast. Leave us a review. Why not? You can do that wherever you get your podcasts, or a rating, or however these things work. I like reading them. It makes me feel good when they're positive. It lets me know what you don't like when they're negative. Also, if you want to say hi, say let me know how I'm doing with this podcast, just drop me an email. It's simon@biographics.org. Biographics spelled the same way that the name of this podcast is spelled. So again, that's simon@biographics.org. Drop me an email. Say hi. Let me know how you like this podcast. And as always, I'll see you next time.